So we're on a section of, under the sort of the larger heading of strength and joy, and following a theme of exercise and enjoyment. This next sutta is from the Samyutta Nikaya, 36, sutta number 31. It's called the Niramisa Sutta. Unworldly. There is, O monks, worldly joy, piti, as joy, and there is unworldly joy, and there is a still greater unworldly joy. There is worldly happiness, so happiness is sukha, there is unworldly happiness, and there is a still greater unworldly happiness. There is worldly equanimity, there is unworldly equanimity, and there is a still greater unworldly equanimity. There is worldly freedom, there is unworldly freedom, and there is a still greater unworldly freedom. Now, O monks, what is worldly joy? There are these five chords of sense desire, forms cognizable by the eye that are wished for and desired, agreeable and endearing, associated with sense desire and tempting to lust. Sounds cognizable by the ear, odors cognizable by the nose, flavors cognizable by the tongue, tangibles cognizable by the body. Wished for and desired, agreeable and endearing, associated with sense desire and tempting to lust. It is the joy that arises dependent on these five chords of sense desire, which is called worldly joy. Now, what is unworldly joy? Quite secluded from sense desires, secluded from unwholesome states of mind, a monk enters upon and abides in the first meditative absorption, which is accompanied by thought conception and discursive thinking, and has joy and happiness born of seclusion. With the stilling of thought conception and discursive thinking, he enters upon and abides in the second meditative absorption, which has internal confidence and singleness of mind without thought conception and discursive thinking, and has joy and happiness born of concentration. This is called unworldly joy. And what is the still greater unworldly joy? When a taint-free monk looks upon his mind that is freed from greed, freed from hatred, freed from delusion, then there arises joy. This is called a still greater unworldly joy. Now, O monks, what is worldly happiness? There are these five chords of sense desire, forms cognizable by the eye, sounds cognizable by the ear, odors cognizable by the nose, flavors cognizable by the tongue, tangibles cognizable by the body that are wished for and desired, agreeable and endearing, associated with sense desire and alluring. It is the happiness and gladness that arises dependent on these five chords of sense desire, which are called worldly happiness. Now, what is unworldly happiness? Quite secluded from sense desires, secluded from unwholesome states of mind, a monk enters upon and abides in the first meditative absorption. And then with the stilling of thought conception and discursive thinking, he enters upon and abides in the second meditative absorption. With the falling away of joy as well, he dwells in equanimity. Mindfully and fully aware, he feels happiness within, and enters upon and abides in the third meditative absorption, of which the noble ones announce. He dwells in happiness who has equanimity and is mindful. This is called unworldly happiness. And what is the still greater unworldly happiness? When a taint-free monk looks upon his mind that is freed of greed, freed of hatred, freed of delusion, then there arises happiness. This is called a still greater unworldly happiness. Now, O monks, what is worldly equanimity? There are these five chords of sensual desire, forms cognizable by the eye, so on through the tangibles cognizable by the body that are wished for and desired, agreeable and endearing, associated with sense desire and alluring. It is the equanimity that arises with regard to these five chords of sense desire, which is called worldly equanimity. Now, what is unworldly equanimity? With the abandoning of pleasure and pain, and with the previous disappearance of gladness and sadness, a monk enters upon and abides in the fourth meditative absorption, which has neither pain nor pleasure, and has purity of mindfulness due to equanimity. This is called unworldly equanimity. And what is the still greater unworldly equanimity? When a taint-free monk looks upon his mind that is freed of greed, freed of hatred, and freed of delusion, then there arises equanimity. This is called a still greater unworldly equanimity. Now, O monks, what is worldly freedom? The freedom connected with the material. What is unworldly freedom? The freedom connected with the immaterial. And what is the still greater unworldly freedom? When a taint-free monk looks upon his mind that is freed of greed, freed of hatred, and freed of delusion, then there arises freedom. It's a great suit there. That is Jnanaponika. Tenchef doesn't have a... and I was going to... The Bhikkhu Bodhis, I don't really quite like his... I thought Jnanaponika's was a bit more... approachable. Because Bhikkhu Bodhi... translates the it's called Samisa Sutta, Samisa Piti and Niramisa Piti, and then I'm not sure what the more spiritual, and then it says there is carnal rapture, there is spiritual rapture, there is rapture more spiritual than the spiritual. Huh? It's a mouthful, so. But it is, you know, it's, again, this that word, amisa or samisa, it does mean, it literally means meat. So it's carnal. it has carnal. Niramisa, sort of beyond. The meaty quality of human existence. The next one.
Freedom associated with material. Mm-hmm.
Well, I would think that freedom from the material is really talking about the, you know, the realm of external realm of the world, and then the immaterial, and I'll bet in the commentaries that it's really defined more in terms of jhana. The rupa jhanas and the arupa jhanas, but you know, if one takes it on a more pedestrian level, then you know, the worldly free being connect the freedom connected with the material realm, the realm of objects and the external world, and then the unworldly freedom, the freedom connected with the immaterial in terms of maybe moods and mind and whatnot. And I think both have their application. Freedom is always always. I mean, you always come back to: is there suffering or not suffering? Yeah. I mean, the Buddha's always, you know, coming back to that as your definition of what is it that is important, and what is it that defines these things. Because somebody could be free from, you know, divested of all the material things, but still be suffering miserably. It doesn't necessarily convey freedom. Or as in the there's a, you know, great discourse of the when the the Buddha is praised by a wanderer, I think a wanderer of another sect or something, because of his kind of his simplicity and his or the definition of sort of spiritual accomplishment was around the sense of asceticism and simplicity, and the Buddha saying, well, you know, that's not necessarily the case, because, you know, I've got disciples who are much more ascetic than me, but you know, they're you know, there's this lovely thing, you know, some monks, you know, they subsist on, you know, very small amounts of food, and you know, sometimes I'll eat as much as a whole bowlful of, you know, really fine delicacies that are offered by the sort of the rulers of the day, the high. Or, you know, there's monks who live with just on rag robes, and you know, I sometimes wear, you know, pretty posh robes and things like that. Or living in pretty comfortable surroundings. So, but he's not suffering over it. Not. Or creating attachments. Okay. The next sutta is moving into the concentration. So the aspects of samadhi and say the enjoyment and development in the development and cultivation of samadhi. This sutta is from Anguttara 4, sutta number 41. There are, O monks, these four kinds of development of concentration. What for? There is a development of concentration that leads to a pleasant dwelling in this very life. There is a development of concentration that leads to obtaining knowledge and vision. There is a development of concentration that leads to mindfulness and clear comprehension. And there is a development of concentration that leads to the destruction of the taints. And what, monks, is the development of concentration that leads to a pleasant dwelling in this very life? Here, secluded from sensual pleasures, secluded from unwholesome states, a monk enters and dwells in the first jhana, which is accompanied by thought and examination, with rapture and happiness born of seclusion. With the subsiding of thought and examination, he enters and dwells in the second jhana, which has internal confidence and unification of mind, is without thought and examination, and has rapture and happiness born of concentration. With the fading away as well of rapture, he dwells equanimous. And, mindful and clearly comprehending, he experiences happiness with the body. He enters and dwells in the third jhana, of which the noble ones declare, he is equanimous, mindful, one who dwells happily. With the abandoning of pleasure and pain, and with the previous passing away of joy and sadness, he enters and dwells in the fourth jhana, which is neither painful nor pleasant, and includes the purification of mindfulness by equanimity. This is called the development of concentration that leads to a pleasant dwelling in this very life. And what is the development of concentration that leads to obtaining knowledge and vision? Here a monk attends to the perception of light. He resolves upon the perception of daytime. As by day, so at night. As at night, so by day. Thus, with an open and unencumbered heart, he develops a luminous mind. This is the development of concentration that leads to obtaining knowledge and vision. And what is the development of concentration that leads to mindfulness and clear comprehension? Here, for a monk, feelings are understood as they arise, as they remain present, as they pass away. Perceptions are understood as they arise, as they remain present, as they pass away. Thoughts are understood as they arise, as they remain present, as they pass away. This is the development of concentration that leads to mindfulness and clear comprehension. And what is the development of concentration that leads to the destruction of the taints? Here a monk dwells contemplating rise and fall in the five aggregates subject to clinging, such as form, such its arising, such its passing away, such as feeling, such its arising, such its passing away, such as perception, such its arising, such its passing away. Such are volitional formations, such its arising, such its passing away. Such is consciousness, such its arising, such its passing away. This is the development of concentration that leads to the destruction of the taints. These, monks, are the four kinds of development of concentration. And with reference to this, it was said by me in the Questions of Punika in the Way to the Far Shore. Having comprehended in the world the high and low, for him there is no disturbance anywhere. Peaceful, fumeless, undistressed, desireless, he has, I say, crossed birth and decay. So that Questions of Punika in the Way to the Far Shore is from the Sutta Nipata. And thought I would read those verses for you. They're from Punika's questions. Okay. So those verses said, when a person has assessed the world from top to bottom, the master said, when there is nothing in the world that raises a flicker of agitation, then he has become a person free from the smoke fumes, the tremblings, and the hunger of desire. He has become calm. He has gone beyond getting old. He has gone beyond being born. That's in the last section of the Sutta Nipata. And the next sutta is from Anguttara 5, sutta number 28, continuing on the theme of concentration, and this is about the factors of concentration. I have heard that on one occasion the Blessed One was staying at Savati in Jeta's Grove, Anathapindika's monastery. There he addressed the monks. Monks, I will teach you the five-factored noble right concentration. Listen and pay close attention. I will speak. As you say, Lord, the monks replied. The Blessed One said, now what, monks, is five-factored noble right concentration? There is the case where a monk, quite withdrawn from sensuality, withdrawn from unskillful qualities, enters and remains in the first jhana. Rapture and pleasure born from withdrawal, accompanied by directed thought and evaluation. He permeates and pervades, suffuses and fills this very body with the rapture and pleasure born from withdrawal. There is nothing of his entire body unpervaded by rapture and pleasure born from withdrawal. Just as if a skilled bathman or a bathman's apprentice would pour bath water into a brass basin and knead it together, sprinkling it again and again with water, so that his ball of bath powder, saturated, moisture-laden, permeated within and without, would nevertheless not drip. Even so, The monk permeates, suffuses, and fills this very body with the rapture and pleasure born of withdrawal. There is nothing of his entire body unpervaded by rapture and pleasure born from withdrawal. This is the first development of the five-factored noble right concentration. Then, with the stilling of directed thought and evaluation, he enters and remains in the second jhana, rapture and pleasure born of composure, unification of awareness, free from directed thought and evaluation, internal assurance. He permeates and pervades, suffuses and fills this very body with the rapture and pleasure born of composure. There is nothing of his entire body unpervaded by rapture and pleasure born of composure. Just like a lake with spring water welling up from within, having no inflow from east, west, north, or south, and with the skies periodically supplying abundant showers, so that the cool fount of water welling up from within the lake would permeate and pervade, suffuse and fill it with cool waters, there being no part of the lake unpervaded by the cool waters. Even so, the monk permeates and pervades, suffuses and fills this very body with the rapture and pleasure born of composure. There is nothing of his entire body unpervaded by rapture and pleasure born of composure. This is the second development of the five-factored noble right concentration. Then, with the fading of rapture, he remains in equanimity, mindful and alert, and physically sensitive to pleasure. He enters and remains in the third jhana, and of him the noble ones declare, equanimous and mindful, he has a pleasurable abiding. He permeates and pervades, suffuses and fills this very body with the pleasure divested of rapture, so that there is nothing of his entire body unpervaded with pleasure divested of rapture. Just as in a blue, white, or red lotus pond, there may be some of the blue, white, or red lotuses which, born and growing in the water, stay immersed in the water and flourish without standing up out of the water, so that they are permeated and pervaded, suffused and filled with cool water from their roots to their tips, and nothing of those blue, white, or red lotuses would be unpervaded with cool water. Even so, the monk permeates and pervades, suffuses and fills this very body with the pleasure divested of rapture. There is nothing of his entire body unpervaded with pleasure divested of rapture. This is the third development of the five-factored noble right concentration. Then, with the abandoning of pleasure and stress, as with the earlier disappearance of elation and distress, he enters and remains in the fourth jhana, purity of equanimity and mindfulness, neither pleasure nor pain. He sits permeating the body with a pure, bright awareness, so that there is nothing of his entire body unpervaded by pure, bright awareness. Just as if a man were sitting wrapped from head to foot with a white cloth, so that there would be no part of his body to which the white cloth did not extend, even so the monk sits, permeating his body with a pure, bright awareness. There is nothing of his entire body unpervaded by pure, bright awareness. This is the fourth development of the five-factored noble right concentration. And furthermore, the monk has his theme of reflection well in hand, well attended to, well considered, well tuned, well penetrated by means of discernment. Just as if one person were to reflect on another, or a standing person were to reflect on a sitting person, or a sitting person were to reflect on a person lying down, even so, monks, the monk has his theme of reflection well in hand, well attended to, well pondered, well tuned, well penetrated by means of discernment. This is the fifth development of the five-factored noble right concentration. When a monk has developed and pursued the five-factored noble right concentration in this way, then whichever of the six higher knowledges he turns his mind to know and realize, he can witness them for himself whenever there is an opening. Suppose that there were a water jar set on a stand, brim full of water, so that a crow could drink from it. If a strong man were to tip it in any way at all, would water spill out? Yes, Lord. In the same way, when a monk has developed and pursued the five-factored noble right concentration in this way, then whichever of the six higher knowledges he turns his mind to know and realize, he can witness them for himself whenever there is an opening. Description of the four jhanas and their illustrations they're all very relevant, and in particular it's very striking one is the sense of working with that concentration and the feeling in the sense of permeating and pervading, suffusing and filling. One is really working with the feeling and concentration, what perceptions that are arising, the stilling and settling of the mind, and then in conjunction with the body. This is not a disembodied experience to settle the mind. The mind does not, and one doesn't sort of toss the body out, but one is using that bodily experience to help to settle and focus. And then that last fifth factor of making sure that the theme of reflection, the theme of contemplation, the theme of attention or concentration is looked after, it's attended to, it's, you're considering it, you're working with it, you're not sort of zoning out, you're not leaving it behind, you're working with that reflection and its implications and its applications. Okay, the next sutta, Sanguttara 5, sutta number 26. There are, O monks, these five bases of liberation. And when a monk dwells diligent, ardent, and resolute in any of these, his unliberated mind comes to be liberated, his undestroyed taints undergo destruction, and he attains the as yet unattained, unsurpassed security from bondage. What five? Hear, monks, the teacher or a certain fellow monk in the position of a teacher teaches the Dhamma to a monk. Even as the teacher is sort of capitalized here, and so meaning referring to the Buddha. Even as the teacher teaches the Dhamma to him, that monk experiences the meaning and the Dhamma. When he gains such experience, gladness arises. When he is gladdened, rapture arises. For one uplifted by rapture, the body becomes calm. One calm in body feels happy. For one who is happy, the mind becomes concentrated. This is the first base of liberation, and when a monk dwells diligent, ardent, and resolute here, his unliberated mind comes to be liberated, his undestroyed taints undergo destruction, and he attains the as yet unattained, unsurpassed security from bondage. Further, monks, neither the teacher nor a fellow monk in the position of a teacher teaches the Dhamma to a monk, but the monk himself teaches the Dhamma in detail to others as he has learnt it and mastered it. Even as he teaches the Dhamma, that monk experiences the meaning and the Dhamma. When he gains such experience, gladness arises. When he is gladdened, rapture arises. For one uplifted by rapture, the body becomes calm, and one calm in body feels happy. For one who is happy, the mind becomes concentrated. This is the second base of liberation. Further, monks, neither the teacher nor a fellow monk in the position of a teacher teaches the Dhamma to a monk, nor does he himself teach the Dhamma in detail to others as he has learnt it and mastered it. But he recites the Dhamma in detail as he has learnt it and mastered it. Even as he recites the Dhamma, that monk experiences the meaning and the Dhamma. When he gains such experience, gladness arises, and so on through the mind becomes concentrated. This is the third base of liberation. Further, monks, neither the teacher nor a fellow monk in the position of a teacher teaches the Dhamma to a monk, nor does he himself teach the Dhamma in detail to others, nor does he recite the Dhamma in detail. But he ponders, examines, and mentally investigates the Dhamma as he has learnt it and mastered it. Even as he ponders the Dhamma, that monk experiences the meaning and the Dhamma. When he gains such experience, gladness arises. So on, the monk becomes concentrated. This is the fourth base of liberation. Further, monks, neither the teacher nor a fellow monk in the position of a teacher teaches the Dhamma to a monk. Nor does he himself teach the Dhamma in detail to others, nor does he recite the Dhamma in detail, nor does he ponder the Dhamma. But he has learnt well a certain object of concentration, attends to it well, sustains it well, and penetrates it thoroughly with wisdom. Even as he learns well an object of concentration, that monk experiences the meaning and the Dhamma. When he gains such experience, gladness arises. When he is gladdened, rapture arises. For one uplifted by rapture, the body becomes calm. One calm in body feels happy. For one who is happy, the mind becomes concentrated. This is the fifth base of liberation. And when a monk dwells diligent, ardent, and resolute here, his unliberated mind comes to be liberated. His undestroyed taints undergo destruction, and he attains the as yet unattained, unsurpassed security from bondage. These monks are the five bases of liberation, and when a monk dwells diligent, ardent, and resolute in any of these, his unliberated mind comes to be liberated. His undestroyed taints undergo destruction, and he attains the as yet unattained, unsurpassed security from bondage. This next sutta, in sort of taking that theme of enjoyment and extending it to the cultivation of the Brahma-viharas, and also the sense of clearing or dealing with the past as it comes to haunt us in practice. Okay, this is Sanyutta 42, Sutta number 8. On one occasion, the Blessed One was dwelling at Nalanda in Pavarika's mango grove. Then Asibanda Kaputta, the headman, a lay disciple of the Ningantas, approached the Blessed One. The Blessed One then said to him, as he was sitting to one side, "In what way, head man, does Nigantha Nataputta teach the Dhamma to his disciples?" "Venerable Sir, Nigantha Nataputta teaches the Dhamma to his disciples thus. Anyone at all who destroys life is bound for a state of misery, bound for hell. Anyone at all who takes what is not given is bound for a state of misery, bound for hell. Anyone at all who engages in sexual misconduct is bound for a state of misery, bound for hell. Anyone at all who speaks falsehood is bound for a state of misery, bound for hell. One is led on to rebirth by the manner in which one usually dwells. It is in such a way, Venerable Sir, that Nigantha Nataputta teaches the Dhamma to his disciples. If headman, it were the case that one is led on to rebirth by the manner in which one usually dwells, then, according to Nigantha Nataputta's word, no one at all would be bound for a state of misery, bound for hell. What do you think, headman? In the case of a person who destroys life, if one compares one occasion with another, whether by day or by night, which is more frequent? The occasions when he is destroying life, or those when he is not doing so? In the case of a person who destroys life, Venerable Sir, if one compares one occasion with another, whether by day or by night, the occasions when he is destroying life are infrequent, while those when he is not doing so are frequent. So, headman, if it were the case that one is led on to rebirth by the manner in which one usually dwells, then, according to Nigantha Nataputta's word, no one at all would be bound for a state of misery, bound for hell. What do you think, headman? In the case of a person who takes what is not given, who engages in sexual misconduct, who speaks falsehood, if one compares one occasion with another, whether by day or by night, which is more frequent? The occasions when he is speaking falsehood, or those when he is not speaking falsehood? In the occasion of a person who speaks falsehood, Venerable Sir, if one compares one occasion with another, whether by day or by night, the occasions when he is speaking falsehood are infrequent, while those when he is not speaking falsehood are frequent. So, headman, if it were the case that one is led on to rebirth by the manner in which one usually dwells, then, according to Nigantha Nataputta's word, no one at all would be bound for a state of misery, bound for hell. Here, headman, some teacher holds such a doctrine and view as this. Anyone at all who destroys life, who takes what is not given, who engages in sexual misconduct, who speaks falsehood, is bound for a state of misery, is bound for hell. Then a disciple has full confidence in that teacher. It occurs to him, my teacher holds such a doctrine and view as this. Anyone at all who destroys life is bound for a state of misery, bound for hell. Now, I have destroyed life, so I too am bound for a state of misery, bound for hell. Thus he acquires such a view. If he does not abandon that assertion and that state of mind, and if he does not relinquish that view, then, according to his deserts, he will be, as it were, dropped off in hell. It occurs to him, my teacher holds such a doctrine and view as this. Anyone at all who takes what is not given is bound for a state of misery, bound for hell. Now, I have taken what is not given, so I too am bound for a state of misery, bound for hell. Thus he acquires such a view. If he does not abandon that assertion, that view, he will be, as it were, dropped off in hell. It occurs to him, my teacher holds such a doctrine and view as this. Anyone at all who engages in sexual misconduct is bound for a state of misery, bound for hell. Now I have engaged in sexual misconduct, so I too am bound for a state of misery, bound for hell. Thus he acquires such a view. If he does not abandon that assertion, he will be, as it were, dropped off in hell. It occurs to him, my teacher holds such a doctrine and view as this. Anyone at all who speaks falsehood is bound for a state of misery, bound for hell. Now I have spoken falsehood, so I too am bound for a state of misery, bound for hell. Thus he acquires such a view. If he does not abandon that assertion, he will be, as it were, dropped off in hell. But here, headman, a Tathagata arises in the world, an Arahant, perfectly enlightened, accomplished in true knowledge and conduct, fortunate, knower of the world, unsurpassed leader of persons to be tamed, teacher of devas and humans. The enlightened one, the blessed one, in many ways he criticizes and censures the destruction of life, and he says, abstain from the destruction of life. He criticizes and censures the taking of what is not given, and he says, abstain from taking what is not given. He criticizes and censures sexual misconduct, and he says, abstain from sexual misconduct. He criticizes and censures false speech. And he says, abstain from false speech. Then a disciple has full confidence in that teacher. He reflects thus. In many ways, the Blessed One criticizes and censures the destruction of life. And he says, abstain from the destruction of life. Now, I have destroyed life to such and such an extent. That wasn't proper. That wasn't good. But though I feel regret over this, that evil deed of mine cannot be undone. Having reflected thus, he abandons the destruction of life, and he abstains from the destruction of life in the future. Thus there comes about the abandoning of that evil deed. Thus there comes about the transcending of that evil deed. He reflects thus. In many ways, the Blessed One criticizes and censures the taking of what is not given. And he says, abstain from taking what is not given. Now I have taken what is not given to such and such an extent. That wasn't proper. That wasn't good. But though I feel regret over this, that evil deed of mine cannot be undone. Having reflected thus, he abandons the taking of what is not given, and he abstains from taking what is not given in the future. Thus there comes about the abandoning of that evil deed. Thus there comes about the transcending of that evil deed. He reflects thus. In many ways, the Blessed One criticizes and censures sexual misconduct, and he says, abstain from sexual misconduct. Now, I have engaged in sexual misconduct to such and such an extent. That wasn't proper. That wasn't good. But though I feel regret over this, that evil deed of mine cannot be undone. Having reflected thus, he abandons sexual misconduct and he abstains from sexual misconduct in the future. Thus there comes about the abandoning of that evil deed. Thus there comes about the transcending of that evil deed. He reflects thus. In many ways, the Blessed One criticizes and censures false speech. And he says, abstain from false speech. Now I have spoken falsehood to such and such an extent. That wasn't proper. That wasn't good. But though I feel regret over this, that evil deed of mine cannot be undone. Having reflected thus, he abandons false speech and he abstains from false speech in the future. Thus there comes about the abandoning of that evil deed. Thus there comes about the transcending of that evil deed. Having abandoned the destruction of life, he abstains from the destruction of life. Having abandoned the taking of what is not given, he abstains from the taking of what is not given. Having abandoned sexual misconduct, he abstains from sexual misconduct. Having abandoned false speech, he abstains from false speech. Having abandoned divisive speech, he abstains from divisive speech. Having abandoned harsh speech, he abandons harsh speech. Having abandoned idle chatter, he abstains from idle chatter. Having abandoned covetousness, he is uncovetous. Having abandoned ill will and hatred, he has a mind without ill will. Having abandoned wrong view, he is one of right view. Then, headman, that noble disciple, who is thus devoid of covetousness, devoid of ill will, unconfused, clearly comprehending, ever mindful, dwells pervading one quarter with a mind imbued with loving kindness. Likewise, the second quarter, the third quarter, and the fourth quarter. Thus, above, below, across, and everywhere, and to all as to himself, he dwells pervading the entire world with a mind imbued with loving kindness. Vast, exalted, measureless, without hostility, without ill will. Just as a strong conch blower can easily send his signal to the four quarters, so too, when the liberation of mind by loving kindness is developed and cultivated in this way, any limited karma that was done does not remain there, does not persist there. He dwells pervading one quarter with a mind imbued with compassion, with a mind imbued with altruistic joy, with a mind imbued with equanimity, likewise the second quarter, third quarter, and the fourth quarter. Thus above, below, across, and everywhere, and to all as to himself. He dwells pervading the entire world with a mind imbued with equanimity, vast, exalted, measureless, without hostility, without ill will. Just as a strong conch blower can easily send his signal to the four quarters, so too, when the liberation of mind by equanimity is developed and cultivated in this way, any limited karma that was done does not remain there, does not persist there. When this was said, Asibanda Kaputta, the headman, said to the Blessed One, "Magnificent, Venerable Sir, magnificent. From today forward, let the Blessed One remember me as a lay follower who has gone for refuge for life." Saying that limited karma what the commentary says is that, and they call it limited karma, sense sphere karma, does not linger on, does not stay on in that form sphere or formless sphere karma. So that sense sphere karma, or that limited karma, is unable to overpower the form sphere, the formless sphere. So as one cultivates sort of higher either rupa jhana or arupa jhana. They talk about it in terms of jhana, but in terms of that power of concentration or power of goodness, power of clarity. So it's that sort of the lower karma is unable to overpower those sort of more refined states of consciousness or being, or to persist and gain the opportunity to yield its own results. So rather, as a great flood might inundate a little stream, the sort of those higher forms of karma, form sphere or formless sphere, overpower the sense sphere karma and remain after having made an opportunity for its own results. Okay, the superior karma, having prevented the sense sphere karma from producing its result on its own, leads to rebirth, on its own, leads to rebirth in a Brahma world. Right. Yeah. In a big glass of water. Yeah. In a big river. Yeah. It just isn't able to grab a hold. And I thought it's also interesting that according to the belief that somebody, you know, if you hold the belief that if you've done this karma, then you're going to reap the results of it. Then you're going to reap the results of it. If I believe that I'm a nasty, evil person because I once, stole a quarter from my brother's piggy bank, you're done for. you hold that belief. You say, you've got to reap the karma of every single and fall into hell because of transgressing the precepts. But the Buddha isn't giving license to unskillful action, but it's sort of getting it in its proper perspective. Well, the fifth, see what the Buddha is tying that into is the 10 courses of unwholesome conduct, so that the akusala kammapada, the basis of unwholesome kamma, so that taking life, stealing, sexual misconduct, lying, divisive speech, harsh speech, idle chatter, covetousness, ill will, wrong view, are always unwholesome karma. They're always going to be unwholesome. It's always unwholesome karma. Whereas, taking of intoxicants is not necessarily in and of itself always you know, irreversibly always an unwholesome mental state, so that the Buddha doesn't include it in that, but he includes it in the precepts because it almost invariably leads to unwholesome. But the, you know, so that it's a course of action that is leading one into that which is lower. And the Buddha is very precise, so that if something, and in this case he's talking about, you know, what is, you know, irrevocably an unwholesome mental state, and leading to an unwholesome result, and that's these things. When there's something that he's giving encouragement to, standards which help people to live skillfully, then that refraining from intoxicants is always put in, because it just helps the mind to have that much more clarity, to be able to have discernment and not get befuddled.